theory, launch a baseball 14 giraffes high. But what about projectiles other than a baseball? Obviously, with the aid of tools like slings, crossbows, or the curved Shistera scoops in Hi-Li, we can launch projectiles much faster than that. But for this question, let's assume we stick to barehanded throwing. A baseball is probably not the ideal projectile, but it's hard to find speed data on other kinds of thrown objects. Fortunately, a British javelin thrower named Roald Bradstock held a random object throwing competition in which he threw everything from dead fish to an actual kitchen sink. Bradstock's experience gives us a lot of useful data, and a lot of other data, too. In particular, it suggests a potentially superior projectile, a golf ball. Few professional athletes have been recorded throwing golf balls. Fortunately, Bradstock has, and he claims a record throw of 170 yards. This involved a running start, but even so, it's reason to think that a golf ball might work better than a baseball. From a physics standpoint, it makes sense. The limiting factor in baseball pitches is the torque on the elbow, and the lighter golf ball might allow the pitching arm to move slightly faster. The speed improvement from using a golf ball instead of a baseball would probably not be very large, but it seems plausible that a professional pitcher with some time to practice could throw a golf ball faster than a baseball. If so, based on aerodynamic calculations, Aroldis Chapman could probably throw a golf ball about 16 giraffes high. This is probably the maximum possible altitude for a thrown object, unless you count the technique by which any 5-year-old can beat all these records easily, releasing a balloon. Chapter 32, Lethal Neutrinos. Question. How close would you have to be to a supernova to get a lethal dose of neutrino radiation? Dr. Donald Spector. Answer. The phrase lethal dose of neutrino radiation is a weird one. I had to turn it over in my head a few times after I heard it. If you're not a physics person, it might not sound odd to you, so here's a little context for why it's such a surprising idea. Neutrinos are ghostly particles that barely interact with the world at all. Look at your hand. There are about a trillion neutrinos from the sun passing through it every second. The reason you don't notice the neutrino flood is that neutrinos mostly ignore ordinary matter. On average, out of that massive flood, only one neutrino will hit an atom in your body every few years, less often if you're a child, since you have fewer atoms to be hit. Statistically, your first neutrino interaction probably happens somewhere around age 10. In fact, neutrinos are so shadowy that the entire Earth is transparent to them. Nearly all of the sun's neutrino stream goes straight through it, unaffected. To detect neutrinos, people build giant tanks filled with hundreds of tons of target material in the hopes that they'll register the impact of a single solar neutrino. This means that when a particle accelerator, which produces neutrinos, wants to send a neutrino beam to a detector somewhere else in the world, all it has to do is point the beam at the detector, even if it's on the other side of the Earth. That's why the phrase lethal dose of neutrino radiation sounds weird. It mixes scales in an incongruous way. It's like the idiom knock me over with a feather, or the phrase football stadium filled to the brim with ants, which would still be less than 1% of the ants in the world. If you have a math background, it's sort of like seeing the expression natural log of x to the power of e. It's not that taken literally, it doesn't make sense. It's that you can't imagine a situation where it would apply. If you want to be mean to first-year calculus students, you can ask them to take the derivative of natural log of x to the power of e dx. It looks like it should be I or something, but it's not. Similarly, it's hard to produce enough neutrinos to get even a single one of them to interact with matter. It's strange to imagine a scenario in which there'd be enough of them to hurt you. Supernovae provide that scenario. Supernovas is also fine. Supernovae is discouraged. Dr. Spector, the Hobart and William Smith College's physicist who asked me this question, told me his rule of thumb for estimating supernova-related numbers. However big you think supernovae are, they're bigger than that. Here's a question to give you a sense of scale. Which of the following would be brighter in terms of the amount of energy delivered to your retina? A supernova seen from as far away as the sun is from the Earth, or the detonation of a hydrogen bomb pressed against your eyeball? Applying Dr. Spector's rule of thumb suggests that the supernova is brighter, and indeed it is, by 9 orders of magnitude. That's why this is a neat question. Supernovae are unimaginably huge, and neutrinos are unimaginably insubstantial. At what point do these two unimaginable things cancel out to produce an effect on a human scale? A paper by radiation expert Andrew Karam provides an answer. It explains that during certain supernovae, the collapse of a stellar core into a neutron star, 10 to the 57th neutrinos can be released, one for every proton in the star that collapses to become a neutron. Karam calculates that the neutrino radiation dose at a distance of 1 parsec, 3.262 light years, or a little less than the distance from here to Alpha Centauri, would be around half a nanosievert, or 1/500th the dose from eating a banana. Radiation dose chart, xkcd.com/radiation. A fatal radiation dose is about 4 sieverts. Using the inverse square law, we can calculate the radiation dose. 0.5 nanosieverts times 1 parsec divided by x squared equals 5 sieverts. X equals 0.0001118 parsecs equals 2.3 AU. That's a little more than the distance between the sun and Mars. Core collapse supernovae happen to giant stars. So, if you observed a supernova from that distance, you'd probably be inside the outer layers of the star that created it. The idea of neutrino radiation damage reinforces just how big supernovae are. If you observed a supernova from 1 AU away, and you somehow avoided being incinerated, vaporized, and converted to some type of exotic plasma, even the flood of ghostly neutrinos would be dense enough to kill you. If it's going fast enough, a feather can absolutely knock you over. Weird and worrying questions from the What If inbox, number 8. Question. A toxin blocks the ability of the nephron tubule reabsorption, but does not affect filtration. What are the possible short-term effects of this toxin? Mary. Doctor, the patient is losing consciousness. We need a decision.
Hang on. I want to get an internet cartoonist to weigh in.
Question. If a Venus flytrap could eat a person, about how long would it take for the human to be fully dejuiced and absorbed? Jonathan Wang. 7 years if the person is chewing gum. That's an urban legend. And I bet Boba Fett was chewing gum when the Sarlacc ate him. It all fits! I can't believe a university gave you a science degree. Chapter 33. Speed Bump. Question. How fast can you hit a speed bump while driving and live? Merlin Barber. Answer. Surprisingly fast. First, a disclaimer. After reading this answer, don't try to drive over speed bumps at high speeds. Here are some reasons. You could hit and kill someone. It can destroy your tires, suspension, and potentially your entire car. Have you listened to any of the other answers in this book? If that's not enough, here are some quotes from medical journals on spinal injury from speed bumps. Examination of the thoracolumbar X-ray and computed tomography displayed compression fractures in 4 patients. Posterior instrumentation was applied. All patients recovered well, except for the one with cervical fracture. L1 was the most frequently fractured vertebra, 23 out of 52, 44.2%. Incorporation of the buttocks with realistic properties diminished the first vertical natural frequency from approximately 12 to 5.5 hertz in agreement with the literature. That last one isn't directly related to speed bump injuries, but I wanted to include it anyway. Regular little speed bumps probably won't kill you. Speed bumps are designed to make drivers slow down. Going over a typical speed bump at 5 miles per hour results in a gentle bounce. Like anyone with a physics background, I do all my calculations in SI units. But I've gotten too many U.S. speeding tickets to write this answer in anything but miles per hour. It's just been burned into my brain. Sorry. While hitting one at 20 delivers a sizable jolt. It's natural to assume that hitting a speed bump at 60 would deliver a proportionally larger jolt, but it probably wouldn't. As those medical quotes attest, it's true that people are occasionally injured by speed bumps. However, nearly all of those injuries happen to a very specific category of people, those sitting in hard seats in the backs of buses, riding on poorly maintained roads. When you're driving a car, the two main things protecting you from bumps in the road are the tires and the suspension. No matter how fast you hit a speed bump, unless the bump is large enough to hit the frame of the car, enough of the jolt will be absorbed by these two systems that you probably won't be hurt. Absorbing the shock won't necessarily be good for those systems. In the case of the tires, they may absorb it by exploding. Just Google hit a curb at 60. If the bump is large enough to hit the wheel rims, it may permanently damage a lot of important parts of the car. The typical speed bump is between 3 and 4 inches tall. That's also about how thick an average tire's cushion is, the separation between the bottom of the rims and the ground. There are cars everywhere. Go outside with a ruler and check. This means that if a car hits a small speed bump, the rim won't actually touch the bump. The tire will just be compressed. The typical sedan has a top speed of around 120 miles per hour. Hitting a speed bump at that speed would, in one way or another, probably result in losing control of the car and crashing. At high speeds, you can easily lose control, even without hitting a bump. Joey Honeycutt's 220 miles per hour crash left his Camaro a burned-out hulk. However, the jolt itself probably wouldn't be fatal. If you hit a larger speed bump, like a speed hump or speed table, your car might not fare so well. How fast would you have to go to definitely die? Let's consider what would happen if a car were going faster than its top speed. The average modern car is limited to a top speed of around 120 miles per hour, and the fastest can go about 200. While most passenger cars have some kind of artificial speed limits imposed by the engine computer, the ultimate physical limit to a car's top speed comes from air resistance. This type of drag increases with the square of speed. At some point, a car doesn't have enough engine power to push through the air any faster. If you did force a sedan to go faster than its top speed, perhaps by reusing the magical accelerator from the relativistic baseball, the speed bump would be the least of your problems. Cars generate lift. The air flowing around a car exerts all kinds of forces on it. The lift forces are relatively minor at normal highway speeds. But at higher speeds, they become substantial. In a Formula One car equipped with airfoils, this force pushes downward, holding the car against the track. In a sedan, they lift it up. Among NASCAR fans, there's frequently talk of a 200 miles per hour liftoff speed if the car starts to spin. Other branches of auto racing have seen spectacular backflip crashes when the aerodynamics don't work out as planned. The bottom line is that in the range of 150 to 300 miles per hour, a typical sedan would lift off the ground, tumble, and crash before you even hit the bump. If you kept the car from taking off, the force of the wind at those speeds would strip away the hood, side panels, and windows. At higher speeds, the car itself would be disassembled and might even burn up like a spacecraft re-entering the atmosphere. What's the ultimate limit? In the state of Pennsylvania, drivers may see $2 added to their speeding ticket for every mile per hour by which they break the speed limit. Therefore, if you drove a car over a Philadelphia speed bump at 90% of the speed of light, in addition to destroying the city, you could expect a speeding ticket of $1.14 billion. Chapter 34, Lost Immortals. Question. If two immortal people were placed on opposite sides of an uninhabited Earth-like planet, how long would it take them to find each other? 100,000 years? 1 million years? 1 billion years? Ethan Lake. Answer. We'll start with the simple physicist-style answer, assuming a spherical immortal human in a vacuum. 3,000 years. That's about how long it would take two people to find each other, assuming that they were walking around at random over a sphere for 12 hours per day and had to get within a kilometer to see each other. We can immediately see some problems with this model. Like, what happened to all the other people? Are they okay? The simplest problem is the assumption that you can always see someone if they come within a kilometer of you. That's possible under only the most ideal circumstances. A person walking along a ridge might be visible from a kilometer away, whereas in a thick forest during a rainstorm, two people could pass within a few meters without seeing each other. We could try to calculate the average visibility across all parts of the Earth, but then we run into another question. Why would two people who are trying to find each other spend time in a thick jungle? It would seem to make more sense for both of them to stay in flat, open areas where they could easily see and be seen. Although the visibility calculation does sound fun. I know what I'm doing next Saturday night. Once we start considering the psychology of our two people, our spherical immortal in a vacuum model is in trouble, which is why we usually try not to consider things like that. Why should we assume our people will walk around randomly at all? The optimal strategy might be something totally different. What strategy would make the most sense for our lost immortals? If they have time to plan beforehand, it's easy. They can arrange to meet at the North Pole or South Pole, or if those turn out to be unreachable, at the highest point on land or the mouth of the longest river. If there's any ambiguity, they can just travel between all the options at random. They have plenty of time. If they don't have a chance to communicate beforehand, things get a little harder. Without knowing the other person's strategy, how do you know what your strategy should be? There's an old puzzle from before the days of cell phones that goes something like this. Suppose you're meeting a friend in an American town that neither of you have been to before. You don't have a chance to plan a meeting place beforehand. Where do you go? The author of the puzzle suggested that the logical solution would be to go to the town's main post office and wait at the main receiving window where out-of-town packages arrive. His logic was that it's the only place that every town in the U.S. has exactly one of, and which everyone would know where to find. To me, that argument seems a little weak. More importantly, it doesn't hold up experimentally. I've asked that question to a number of people, and none of them suggested the post office. The original author of that puzzle would be waiting in the mailroom alone. Our lost immortals have it tougher, since they don't know anything about the geography of the planet they're on. Following the coastlines seems like a sensible move. Most people live near water, and it's much faster to search along a line than over a plane. If your guess turns out to be wrong, you won't have wasted much time compared to having searched the interior first. Walking around the average continent would take about 5 years, based on typical width-to-coastline length ratios for Earth land masses. Of course, some areas would present a challenge. Louisiana's bayous, the Caribbean's mangrove forests, and Norway's fjords would all make for slower walking than a typical beach. Let's assume you and the other person are on the same continent. If you both walk counterclockwise, you could circle forever without finding each other. That's no good. A different approach would be to make a complete circle counterclockwise, then flip a coin. If it comes up heads, circle counterclockwise again. If tails, go clockwise. If you're both following the same algorithm, this would give you a high probability of meeting within a few circuits. The assumption that you're both using the same algorithm is probably optimistic. Fortunately, there's a better solution. Be an ant. Here's the algorithm that I would follow. If you're ever lost on a planet with me, keep this in mind. If you have no information, walk at random, leaving a trail of stone markers, each one pointing to the next. For every day that you walk, rest for 3. Periodically mark the date alongside the cairn. It doesn't matter how you do this, as long as it's consistent. You could chisel the number of days into a rock, or lay out rocks to plot the number. If you come across a trail that's newer than any you've seen before, start following it as fast as you can. If you lose the trail and can't recover it, resume leaving your own trail. You don't have to come across the other player's current location. You simply have to come across a location where they've been. You can still chase one another in circles, but as long as you move more quickly when you're following a trail than when you're leaving one, you'll find each other in a matter of years or decades. And if your partner isn't cooperating, perhaps they're just sitting where they started and waiting for you, then you'll get to see some neat stuff. Chapter 35, Orbital Speed. Question. What if a spacecraft slowed down on reentry to just a few miles per hour using rocket boosters like the Mars Sky Crane? Would it negate the need for a heat shield? Brian. Question. Is it possible for a spacecraft to control its reentry in such a way that it avoids the atmospheric compression and thus would not require the expensive and relatively fragile heat shield on the outside? Christopher Mallow. Question. Could a small rocket with payload be lifted to a high point in the atmosphere where it would only need a small rocket to get to escape velocity? Kenny Vandermeel. Answer. The answers to these questions all hinge on the same idea. It's an idea I've touched on in other answers, but right now I want to focus on it specifically. The reason it's hard to get into orbit isn't that space is high up. It's hard to get to orbit because you have to go so fast to stay there. Space is about 100 kilometers away. That's far away. I wouldn't want to climb a ladder to get there. But it isn't that far away. If you're in Sacramento, Seattle, Canberra, Kolkata, Hyderabad, Phnom Penh, Cairo, Beijing, Central Japan, Central Sri Lanka, or Portland, space is closer than the sea. Getting to space is easy, specifically low Earth orbit, which is where the International Space Station is and is where shuttles could go. It's not like something you could do in your car, but it's not a huge challenge. You could get a person to space with a rocket the size of a telephone pole. The X-15 aircraft reached space just by going fast and then steering up. The X-15 reached 100 kilometers on 2 occasions, both when flown by Joe Walker. Make sure to remember to steer up and not down, or you will have a bad time. But getting to space is easy. The problem is staying there. Gravity in low Earth orbit is almost as strong as gravity on the surface. The space station hasn't escaped Earth's gravity at all. It's experiencing about 90% of the pull that we feel on the surface. To avoid falling back into the atmosphere, you have to go sideways really, really fast. The speed you need to stay in orbit is about 8 kilometers per second. It's a little less if you're in the higher region of low Earth orbit. Only a fraction of a rocket's energy is used to lift up out of the atmosphere. The vast majority of it is used to gain orbital sideways speed. This leads us to the central problem of getting into orbit. Reaching orbital speed takes much more fuel than reaching orbital height. Getting a ship up to 8 kilometers per second takes a lot of booster rockets. Reaching orbital speed is hard enough. Reaching orbital speed while carrying enough fuel to slow back down would be completely impractical. This exponential increase is the central problem of rocketry. The fuel required to increase your speed by 1 kilometer per second multiplies your weight by about 1.4. To get into orbit, you need to increase your speed to 8 kilometers per second, which means you'll need a lot of fuel. 1.4 times 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 1.4 approximately equals 15 times the original weight of your ship. Using a rocket to slow down carries the same problem. Every 1 kilometer per second decrease in speed multiplies your starting mass by that same factor of 1.4. If you want to slow all the way down to zero and drop gently into the atmosphere, the fuel requirements multiply your weight by 15 again. These outrageous fuel requirements are why every spacecraft entering an atmosphere has braked using a heat shield instead of rockets. Slamming into the air is the most practical way to slow down. And to answer Brian's question, the Curiosity rover was no exception to this. Although it used small rockets to hover when it was near the surface, it first used air braking to shed the majority of its speed. How fast is 8 kilometers per second anyway? I think the reason for a lot of confusion about these issues is that when astronauts are in orbit, it doesn't seem like they're moving that fast. They look like they're drifting slowly over a blue marble. But 8 kilometers per second is blisteringly fast. When you look at the sky near sunset, you can sometimes see the ISS go past, and then, 90 minutes later, see it go past again. There are some good apps and online tools to help you spot the station, along with other neat satellites. In those 90 minutes, it circled the entire world. The ISS moves so quickly that if you fired a rifle bullet from one end of a football field, either kind, the International Space Station could cross the length of the field before the bullet traveled 10 yards. This type of play is legal in Australian rules football. Let's imagine what it would look like if you were speed walking across the Earth's surface at 8 kilometers per second. To get a better sense of the pace at which you're traveling, let's use the beat of a song to mark the passage of time. Using song beats to help measure the passage of time is a technique also used in CPR training, where the song Stayin' Alive is used. Suppose you started playing the 1988 song by the Proclaimers, I'm Gonna Be 500 Miles. That song is about 131.9 beats per minute. So imagine that with every beat of the song, you move forward more than 2 miles. In the time it took to sing the first line of the chorus, you could walk from the Statue of Liberty all the way to the Bronx. You'd be moving at about 15 subway stops per minute. It would take you about 2 lines of the chorus, 16 beats of the song, to cross the English Channel between London and France. The song's length leads to an odd coincidence. The interval between the start and the end of I'm Gonna Be is 3 minutes and 30 seconds, and the ISS is moving at 7.66 kilometers per second. This means that if an astronaut on the ISS listens to I'm Gonna Be in the time between the first beat of the song and the final lines, they will have traveled just about exactly 1,000 miles. Chapter 36, FedEx Bandwidth. Question: when, if ever, will the bandwidth of the Internet surpass that of FedEx? Johann Ubrink. Never underestimate the bandwidth of a station wagon full of tapes hurtling down the highway. Andrew Tannenbaum, 1981. Answer: if you want to transfer a few hundred gigabytes of data, it's generally faster to FedEx a hard drive than to send the files over the Internet. This isn't a new idea. It's often dubbed sneakernet, and it's even how Google transfers large amounts of data internally. But will it always be faster? Cisco estimates that total Internet traffic currently averages 167 terabits per second. FedEx has a fleet of 654 aircraft with a lift capacity of 26.5 million pounds daily. A solid-state laptop drive weighs about 78 grams and can hold up to a terabyte. That means FedEx is capable of transferring 150 exabytes of data per day, or 14 petabits per second, almost 100 times the current throughput of the Internet. If you don't care about cost, this 10-kilogram shoebox can hold a lot of Internet. Top-end laptop drives, 136. Storage, 136 terabytes. Cost, $130,000 plus $40 for the shoes. We can improve the data density even further by using microSD cards. MicroSD cards, 25,000. Storage, 1.6 petabytes. Retail cost, $1.2 million. Those thumbnail-sized flakes have a storage density of up to 160 terabytes per kilogram, which means a FedEx fleet loaded with microSD cards could transfer about 177 petabits per second, or 2 zettabytes per day, 1,000 times the internet's current traffic level. The infrastructure would be interesting. Google would need to build huge warehouses to hold a massive card processing operation. Cisco estimates internet traffic is growing at about 29% annually. At that rate, we'll hit the FedEx point in 2040. Of course, the amount of data we can fit on a drive will have gone up by then, too. The only way to actually reach the FedEx point is if transfer rates grow much faster than storage rates. In an intuitive sense, this seems unlikely, since storage and transfer are fundamentally linked. All that data is coming from somewhere and going somewhere. But there's no way to predict usage patterns for sure. While FedEx is big enough to keep up with the next few decades of actual usage, there's no technological reason we can't build a connection that beats them on bandwidth. There are experimental fiber clusters that can handle over a petabit per second. A cluster of 200 of those would beat FedEx. If you recruited the entire U.S. freight industry to move SD cards for you, the throughput would be on the order of 500 exabits, half a zettabit, per second. To match that transfer rate digitally, you'd need to take 500,000 of those petabit cables. So, the bottom line is that for raw bandwidth of FedEx, the internet will probably never beat SneakerNet. However, the virtually infinite bandwidth of a FedEx-based internet would come at a cost of 80 million millisecond ping times. Chapter 37, Freefall. Question: what place on Earth would allow you to freefall the longest by jumping off it? What about using a squirrel suit? Dash Srivatsa. Answer: the largest purely vertical drop on Earth is the face of Canada's Mount Thor, a cliff over a kilometer tall with a slope so steep that the top section of the cliff face actually slopes outward, overhanging the middle. To make the scenario a little less gruesome, let's suppose there's a pit at the bottom of the cliff filled with something fluffy, like cotton candy, to break your fall. A human falling with arms and legs outstretched has a terminal velocity in the neighborhood of 55 meters per second. It takes a few hundred meters to get up to speed, so it would take you a little over 26 seconds to fall the full distance. What can you do in 26 seconds? For starters, it's enough time to get all the way through the original Super Mario World 1-1, assuming you have perfect timing and take the shortcut through the pipe. It's also long enough to miss a phone call. Sprint's ring cycle, the time the phone rings before going to voicemail, is 23 seconds. For those keeping score, that means Wagner's is 2,350 times longer. If someone called your phone and it started ringing the moment you jumped, it would go to voicemail 3 seconds before you reached the bottom. On the other hand, if you jumped off Ireland's 210-meter cliffs of Moher, you would be able to fall for only about 8 seconds, or a little more if the updrafts were strong. That's not very long, but according to River Tam, given adequate vacuuming systems, it might be enough time to drain all the blood from your body. So far, we've assumed you're falling vertically. But you don't have to. Even without any special equipment, a skilled skydiver, once he or she gets up to full speed, can glide at almost a 45-degree angle. By gliding away from the base of the cliff, you could conceivably extend your fall substantially. It's hard to say exactly how far. In addition to the local terrain, it depends heavily on your choice of clothes. As a comment on a Base Jumping Records wiki puts it, the record for longest fall time without a wingsuit is hard to find, since the line between jeans and wingsuits has blurred since the introduction of more advanced apparel. Which brings us to wingsuits, the halfway point between parachute pants and parachutes. Wingsuits let you fall much more slowly. One wingsuit operator posted tracking data from a series of jumps. It shows that in a glide, a wingsuit can lose altitude as slowly as 18 meters per second, a huge improvement over 55. Even ignoring horizontal travel, that would stretch out our fall to over a minute. That's long enough for a chess game. It's also long enough to sing the first verse of, appropriately enough, R.E.M.'s It's the End of the World as We Know It, followed by, less appropriately, the entire breakdown from the end of the Spice Girls' Wannabe. When we include the higher cliffs opened up by horizontal glides, the times get even longer. There are a lot of mountains that could probably support very long wingsuit flights. For example, Nanga Parbat, a mountain in Pakistan, has a drop of more than 3 kilometers at a fairly steep angle. Surprisingly, a wingsuit still works fine in such thin air, though the jumper would still need oxygen, and it would glide a little faster than normal. So far, the record for longest wingsuit base jump is held by Dean Potter, who jumped from the Eiger, a mountain in Switzerland, and flew for 3 minutes and 20 seconds. What could you do with 3 minutes and 20 seconds? Suppose we recruit Joey Chestnut and Takaru Kobayashi, the world's top competitive eaters. If we can find a way for them to operate wingsuits while eating at full speed, and they jumped from the Eiger, they could, in theory, finish as many as 45 hot dogs between them before reaching the ground. Which would, if nothing else, earn them what just might be the strangest world record in history. Weird and worrying questions from the What If inbox, number 9. Question. Could you survive a tidal wave by submerging yourself in an in-ground pool? Chris Muska. Imagine two axes, horizontal and vertical. At one end of horizontal is sounds smart. At one end of horizontal is sounds dumb. At the bottom of the vertical is actually smart. At the top of the vertical is actually dumb. To the lower left, where sounds smart and actually smart are at their extremes, we find sliced bread. In the upper left, where actually dumb and sounds smart nearly reach their extremes, we find the Matrix sequels. In the lower right, where sounds dumb and actually smart reach their extremes, we see laser eye surgery. In the upper right, where actually dumb and sound dumb reach their extremes, we find this idea slightly above plugging a power strip into itself to get free energy. Question. If you are in free fall and your parachute fails, but you have a slinky with extremely convenient mass, tension, etc., would it be possible to save yourself by throwing the slinky upward while holding on to one end of it? Varadarajan Srinivasan. Imagine a sad man in free fall, a slinky uncoiling from his hands. Chapter 38, Sparta. Question. In the movie 300, they shoot arrows up into the sky, and they seemingly blot out the sun. Is this possible, and how many arrows would it take? Anna Newell. Answer. It's pretty hard to make this work. Attempt 1. Longbow archers can fire 8 to 10 arrows per minute. In physics terms, a longbow archer is an arrow generator with a frequency of 150 millihertz. Each arrow spends only a few seconds in the air. If an arrow's average time over the battlefield is 3 seconds, then about 50% of all archers have arrows in the air at any given time. Each arrow intercepts about 40 square centimeters of sunlight. Since archers have arrows in the air only half the time, each blocks an average of 20 square centimeters of sunlight. If the archers are packed in rows, with 2 archers per meter and a row every meter and a half, and the archer battery is 20 rows, 30 meters deep, then, for every meter of width, there will be 18 arrows in the air. 18 arrows will block only about 0.1% of the sun from the firing range. We need to improve on this. Attempt 2. First, we can pack the archers more tightly. If they stand with the density of a mosh pit crowd, a rule of thumb, 1 person per square meter is a light crowd, 4 people per square meter is a mosh pit, we can triple the number of archers per square foot. Sure, it will make firing awkward, but I'm sure they can figure it out. We can expand the depth of the firing column to 60 meters. That gives us a density of 130 archers per meter. How fast can they fire? In the extended edition of the 2001 film Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, there's a scene where a group of orcs charge at Legolas. Strictly speaking, they were Urukai, not typical orcs. The precise nature and origin of the Urukai is a little tricky. Tolkien suggested that they were created by crossbreeding humans with orcs. However, in an earlier draft, published in the Book of Lost Tales, he instead suggests the Uruks have been born from the subterranean heats and slimes of the earth. Director Peter Jackson, when deciding what to show on screen in his film adaptation, wisely went with the latter version. And Legolas draws and fires arrows in rapid succession, felling the attackers with one shot each before they reach him. The actor playing Legolas, Orlando Bloom, couldn't really fire arrows that quickly. He was actually dry-firing an empty bow. The arrows were added using CGI. Since this fire rate appeared to the audience to be impressively fast but not physically implausible, it provides a convenient upper limit for our calculations. Let's assume we can train our archers to replicate Legolas's fire rate of 7 arrows in 8 seconds. In that case, our column of archers, firing an impossible 339 arrows per meter, will still block out only 1.56% of the sunlight passing through them. Attempt 3. Let's dispense with the bows entirely and give our archers arrow-firing Gatling bows. If they can fire 70 arrows per second, that adds up to 110 square meters of arrows per 100 square meters of battlefield. Perfect! But there's a problem. Even though the arrows have a total cross-sectional area of 100 meters, some of them shadow each other. The formula for the fraction of ground coverage by a large number of arrows, some of which overlap each other, is this. The quantity 1 minus the arrow area divided by the ground area is then squared or raised to the second power. With 110 square meters of arrows, you'll cover only 2/3 of the battlefield. Since our eyes judge brightness on a logarithmic scale, reducing the sun's brightness to 1/3 of its normal value will be seen as a slight dimming, certainly not blotting it out. With an even more unrealistic fire rate, we could make it work. If the guns release 300 arrows per second, they would block out 99% of the sunlight reaching the battlefield. But there's an easier way. Attempt 4. We've been making the implicit assumption that the sun is directly overhead. That's certainly what the movie shows. But perhaps the famous boast was based on a plan to attack at dawn. If the sun were low on the eastern horizon and the archers were firing north, then the light could have to pass through the entire column of arrows, potentially multiplying the shadow effect 1,000-fold. Of course, the arrows wouldn't be aimed anywhere near the enemy soldiers, but to be fair, all they said was that their arrows would blot out the sun. They never said anything about hitting anyone. And who knows? Maybe, against the right enemy, that's all they need. Chapter 39. Drain the Oceans. Question. How quickly would the oceans drain if a circular portal 10 meters in radius leading into space were created at the bottom of Challenger Deep, the deepest spot in the ocean? How would the Earth change as the water was being drained? Ted M. Answer. I want to get one thing out of the way first. According to my rough calculations, if an aircraft carrier sank and got stuck against the drain, the pressure would easily be enough to fold it up and suck it through. Cool. Just how far away is this portal? If we put it near the Earth, the ocean would just fall back down into the atmosphere. As it fell, it would heat up and turn to steam, which would condense and fall right back into the ocean as rain. The energy input into the atmosphere alone would also wreak all kinds of havoc with our climate, as would the huge clouds of high-altitude steam. So, let's put the ocean-dumping portal far away, say, on Mars. In fact, I vote we put it directly above the Curiosity rover. That way, it will finally have incontrovertible evidence of liquid water on Mars's surface. What happens to the Earth? Not much. It would actually take hundreds of thousands of years for the ocean to drain. Even though the opening is wider than a basketball court, and the water is forced through at incredible speeds, the oceans are huge. When you started, the water level would drop by less than a centimeter per day. There wouldn't even be a cool whirlpool at the surface. The opening is too small and the ocean is too deep. It's the same reason you don't get a whirlpool in the bathtub until the water is more than halfway drained. But let's suppose we speed up the draining by opening more drains. Remember to clean the whale filter every few days. So the water level starts to drop more quickly. After the oceans have dropped 50 meters, the world map still looks pretty similar to our current one, but with a few changes. Sri Lanka, New Guinea, Great Britain, Java, and Borneo are now connected to their neighbors. And after 2,000 years of trying to hold back the sea, the Netherlands are finally high and dry. No longer living with the constant threat of a cataclysmic flood, they're free to turn their energies toward outward expansion. They immediately spread out and claim the newly exposed land. When the sea level reaches minus 100 meters, a huge new island off the coast of Nova Scotia is exposed, the former site of the Grand Banks. You may start to notice something odd. Not all the seas are shrinking. The Black Sea, for example, shrinks only a little, then stops. This is because these bodies are no longer connected to the ocean. As the water level falls, some basins cut off from the drain in the Pacific. Depending on the details of the seafloor, the flow of water out of the basin might carve a deeper channel, allowing it to continue to flow out, but most of them will eventually become landlocked and stop draining. At 200 meters, the map is starting to look weird. New islands are appearing. Indonesia is a big blob. The Netherlands now control much of Europe. The seas have dropped 500 meters. Japan is now an isthmus, connecting the Korean Peninsula with Russia. New Zealand gains new islands. The Netherlands expand north. The seas have dropped 1 kilometer. New Zealand grows dramatically. The Arctic Ocean is cut off and its water level stops falling. The Netherlands cross the new land bridge into North America. The sea has dropped by 2 kilometers. New islands are popping up left and right. The Caribbean Sea and the Gulf of Mexico are losing their connections with the Atlantic. Bizarre, tentacle-like peninsulas sprout from New Zealand. At 3 kilometers, many of the peaks of the Mid-Ocean Ridge, the world's longest mountain range, break the surface. Rugged new lands emerge across the globe and are promptly absorbed into the Netherlands. The seas have dropped 5 kilometers. By this point, most of the major oceans have become disconnected and stopped draining. The exact locations and sizes of the various inland seas are hard to predict. This is only a rough estimate. When the drain finally empties, there's a surprising amount of water left, although much of it consists of very shallow seas with a few trenches where the water is as deep as 4 or 5 kilometers. Vacuuming up half the oceans would massively alter the climate and ecosystems in ways that are hard to predict. At the very least, it would almost certainly involve a collapse of the biosphere and mass extinctions at every level. But it's possible, if unlikely, that humans could manage to survive. If they did, they'd have this to look forward to: a world of small seas surrounded by land, and all of it part of the Netherlands. Chapter 40, Drain the Oceans, Part 2. Question. Supposing you did drain the oceans and dumped the water on top of the Curiosity rover, how would Mars change as the water accumulated? Ian. Answer. In the previous answer, we opened a portal at the bottom of the Mariana Trench and let the oceans drain out. We didn't worry too much about where the oceans were draining to. I picked Mars. The Curiosity rover is working so hard to find evidence of water, so I figured we could make things easier for it. Curiosity is sitting in Gale Crater, a round depression on the Martian surface with a peak nicknamed Mount Sharp in the center. There's a lot of water on Mars. The problem is it's frozen. Liquid water doesn't last long there because it's too cold and there's too little air. If you set out a cup of warm water on Mars, it'll try to boil, freeze, and sublimate practically all at once. Water on Mars seems to want to be in any state except liquid. However, we're dumping a lot of water very fast, all of it at a few degrees above 0 Celsius, and it won't have much time to freeze, boil, or sublimate. If our portal is big enough, the water will start to turn Gale Crater into a lake, just like it would on Earth. As the flow continues, the lake fills in, burying Curiosity under hundreds of meters of water. Eventually, Mount Sharp becomes an island. However, before the peak can disappear completely, the water spills over the north rim of the crater and starts flowing out across the sand. There is evidence that, due to occasional heat waves, ice in the Martian soil occasionally melts and flows as a liquid. When this happens, the trickle of water quickly dries up before it can get very far. However, we've got a lot of ocean at our disposal. The water pools in the North Polar Basin. Gradually, it will fill the basin. However, if we look at a map of the more equatorial regions of Mars, where the volcanoes are, we'll see that there's still a lot of land far from the water. Frankly, I think this map is kind of boring. There's not a lot going on. It's just a big empty swath of land with some ocean at the top. We haven't come close to running out of ocean yet, although there was a lot of blue on the map of Earth at the end of our last answer. The seas that remained were shallow. Most of the volume of the oceans was gone. And Mars is much smaller than Earth, so the same volume of water will make a deeper sea. At this point, the water fills in the Valles Marineris, creating some unusual coastlines. The map is less boring, but the terrain around the Great Canyons makes for some odd shapes. The water now reaches and swallows up Spirit and Opportunity. Eventually, it breaks into the Hellas Impact Crater, the basin containing the lowest point on Mars. In my opinion, the rest of the map is starting to look pretty good. As the water spreads across the surface in earnest, the map splits into several large islands and innumerable smaller ones. The water quickly finishes covering most of the high plateaus, leaving only a few islands left. And then, at last, the flow stops. The oceans back on Earth are drained. Olympus Mons and a few other volcanoes remain above water. Surprisingly, they aren't even close to being covered. Olympus Mons still rises well over 10 kilometers above the new sea level. Mars has some huge mountains. Those crazy islands are the result of water filling in Noctis Labyrinthus, the labyrinth of the night. A bizarre set of canyons whose origin is still a mystery. The oceans on Mars wouldn't last. There might be some transient greenhouse warming, but in the end, Mars is just too cold. Eventually, the oceans will freeze over, become covered with dust, and gradually migrate to the permafrost at the poles. However, it would take a long time, and until it did, Mars would be a much more interesting place. When you consider that there's a ready-made portal system to allow transit between the two planets, the consequences are inevitable. The Netherlands will conquer Mars. Chapter 41. Twitter. How many unique English tweets are possible? How long would it take for the population of the world to read them all out loud? Eric H., Hapatcong, New Jersey. High up in the north, in the land called Svithjod, there stands a rock. It is 100 miles high and 100 miles wide. Once every 1,000 years, a little bird comes to this rock to sharpen its beak. When the rock has thus been worn away, then a single day of eternity will have gone by. Hendrik Willem van Loon. Answer. Tweets are 140 characters long. There are 26 letters in English, 27 if you include spaces. Using that alphabet, there are 27 to the 140th, approximately equaling 10 to the 200th possible strings. But Twitter doesn't limit you to those characters. You have all of Unicode to play with, which has room for over a million different characters. The way Twitter counts Unicode characters is complicated, but the number of possible strings could be as high as 10 to the 800th. Of course, almost all of them would be meaningless jumbles of characters from a dozen different languages. Even if you're limited to the 26 English letters, the strings would be full of meaningless jumbles like Pitkobji. Eric's question was about tweets that actually say something in English. How many of those are possible? This is a tough question. Your first impulse might be to allow only English words. Then you could further restrict it to grammatically valid sentences. But it gets tricky. For example, "Hi, I'm Mitzelplick" is a grammatically valid sentence if your name happens to be Mitzelplick. Come to think of it, it's just as grammatically valid if you're lying. Clearly, it doesn't make sense to count every string that starts with "Hi, I'm" as a separate sentence. To a normal English speaker, "Hi, I'm Mitzelplick" is basically indistinguishable from "Hi, I'm Miskelquit," and shouldn't both count. But "Hi, I'm ex-Pokefan X" is definitely recognizably different from the first two, even though ex-Pokefan X isn't an English word by any stretch of the imagination. Our way of measuring distinctiveness seems to be falling apart. Fortunately, there's a better approach. Let's imagine a language that has only two valid sentences, and every tweet must be one of the two sentences. They are, "There's a horse in aisle 5. My house is full of traps." The messages are relatively long, but there's not a lot of information in each one. All they tell you is whether the person decided to send the trap message or the horse message. It's effectively a 1 or 0. Although there are a lot of letters, for a reader who knows the pattern of the language, each tweet carries only one bit of information per sentence. This example hits at a very deep idea, which is that information is fundamentally tied to the recipient's uncertainty about the message's content and his or her ability to predict it in advance. It also hints at a very shallow idea about there being a horse in aisle 5. Claude Shannon, who almost single-handedly invented modern information theory, had a clever method for measuring the informational content of a language. He showed groups of people samples of typical written English that were cut off at a random point, then asked them to guess which letter came next. Based on the rates of correct guesses and rigorous mathematical analysis, Shannon determined that the informational content of typical written English was 1.0 to 1.2 bits per letter. This means that a good compression algorithm should be able to compress ASCII English text, which is 8 bits per letter, to about 1/8 of its original size. Indeed, if you use a good file compressor on a .txt ebook, that's about what you'll find. If a piece of text contains n bits of information, in a sense it means there are 2 to the nth different messages it can convey. There's a bit of mathematical juggling here, involving, among other things, the length of the message and something called unicity distance, but the bottom line is that it suggests that there are on the order of about 2 to the 140th times 1.1, approximately 2 times 10 to the 46th meaningfully different English tweets, rather than 10 to the 200th or 10 to the 800th. Now, how long would it take the world to read them all out? Reading 2 times 10 to the 46th tweets would take a person nearly 10 to the 47th seconds. It's such a staggeringly large number of tweets that it hardly matters whether it's one person reading or a billion. They won't be able to make a meaningful dent in the list in the lifetime of the Earth. Instead, let's think back to that bird sharpening its beak on the mountaintop. Suppose that the bird scrapes off a tiny bit of rock from the mountain when it visits every 1,000 years, and it carries away those few dozen dust particles when it leaves. A normal bird would probably deposit more beak material on the mountaintop than it would wear away, but virtually nothing else about this scenario is normal either, so we'll just go with it. Let's say you read tweets aloud for 16 hours a day, every day. And behind you, every 1,000 years, the bird arrives and scrapes off a few invisible specks of dust from the top of the 100-mile mountain with its beak. When the mountain is worn flat to the ground, that's the first day of eternity. The mountain reappears and the cycle starts again for another eternal day. 365 eternal days, each one 10 to the 32nd years long, makes an eternal year. 100 eternal years, in which the bird grinds away 36,500 mountains, make an eternal century. But a century isn't enough, nor a millennium. Reading all the tweets takes you 10